The topic of our panel is current events and their relevance to us. There is no outline for you to share. I just distributed an outline to the panel members, not really an outline, because I'll share with you a little secret. I don't like panels at all. I don't like serving on a panel. I don't like chairing a panel. I think panel discussions are our least exciting, least lively, least energetic of all of our services. The typical format of panels, as you've probably seen in the past, is rather dry. The chairman asks a question, and the panel members go down one by one by one. They give one answer, and then they go on to the next question. And again, I think of panels as real snoozers. I don't blame the brethren when I look out and I see their eyes closing. So I sincerely do not like panel discussions at all. So recognizing that and being assigned as a panel chairman, I gave the panel members here a rather stiff challenge. I said, I'm not going to give you formal questions. We're going to discuss current events and their relevance to us. I've got specific areas of current events marked out. But I'm hoping that our discussion will be rather unstructured and freewheeling, as if we were just sitting around a dinner table. We've just had a nice meal, and we decide to talk about current events and what their relevance is to us, what our Christian growth opportunities are in the current events that we see unfolding around us. And so that's not real comfortable for a lot of the elders. We like to have a specific question, a scripture, a reprint reference, and we find our answer and we give our answer and we feel comfortable preparing for a study or a panel along that way. This is going to be hard on the panel members to have what I hope will be sort of a spontaneous, more high-energy discussion. So I gave no questions, but I said we will have three areas of discussion of current events. The first will be the failing economy. The second will be religion. And the third is sort of a catch-all. It could really be two separate areas, but I combined them into one. I called it social trends and world events. And we'll have maybe 15 or 20 minutes, less than 20 minutes for each of those three. We might go a little longer on the first one if that discussion seems to be going well, the failing economy, because I think it does touch so many of the brethren's lives. But I'll give just a few of the bullet points or phrases, parts of sentences that I suggested could be encompassed in this discussion, this general discussion of the failing economy. And among them are the fact that we recognize that in the world, our friends and neighbors are losing their jobs. Even more, they might be losing their homes, going bankrupt. The brethren are not immune from this either. Some of us are losing our jobs. We're losing our homes. We see unprecedented things in terms of the mortgage crisis, the bailout money being given to banks, huge, iconic American companies going bankrupt like GM and Chrysler. And again, it affects not just the world, but our brethren as well. And so what I want us to discuss in this first part of our open discussion is what are our observations about this and how does it relate to our lives as Bible students, the brethren, what we can do, what we should be doing, what we should be looking forward to in the future. And let me just start by talking to the panel here. And again, please feel free to just grab a microphone and start talking and don't raise your hand and wait for me to call on you. But it seems to me that there's been economic distress in the world before. This is nothing new that we've seen. Most of us are too young to remember the Great Depression thoroughly, at least as adults. And so sometimes we hear it described today that, oh, this is as bad or maybe even worse than what the Great Depression was. And it occurred to me that, well, maybe this is just more of the same of a repeating pattern of prophecy being fulfilled. Anybody have a thought on what we see happening about us in the economy? Aaron?
I'm not old enough to have gone through the Great Depression, but my grandparents did. And my grandfather ran a cheese factory, had his own business. And the day the banks failed, they called him up specifically and said, Alfred, how come you're late with your deposit in the bank? And he said, I'm busy. I'll get there when I get there. So we got there after 1 o'clock, and there was a sign on the door. They closed at 12 noon. And the bank had solicited funds coming in before they closed. Everybody had money in the bank, lost all their money. So needless to say, that generation, our grandparents, had an adverse reaction to the banks. So they would bank their money in their mattresses, or they'd stick it in their backyard, or they'd stick it something that's very liquid. But they lived in a rural area, and they were self-sufficient. So even though they lost a lot of finances, lost a lot of money, they still could grow the garden. They still had friends and neighbors that helped out, and they worked in the community that way. So I think, from a personal experience, because we've lost the family farm, and we've lost our self-sufficiency as a culture and as a society, I think the pinch today is harder for people because they're dependent on an outside source of income. They must have it because they can't support themselves. They don't have the ability to raise their own food, grow their own, you know, animals for food or gardens and stuff. So I think we're feeling it significantly differently than what our great-grandparents might have felt. And, you know, there's always been trouble in the world, but the experiences that the United States went through with this mortgage problem or the subprime mortgage dominoed. And if you follow it, you could trace it as it went right around the whole globe. It was a 6 to 9 month lag, but it just went from country to country. And China was one of the last ones to get severely impacted by it. And it's kind of ironic because China is the one that's investing all their money into the United States. And so now we're expecting China to continue to invest in our economy to help us stay afloat, but they're having problems in their own economy. So if they pull back, then it means that our economy spirals even faster. I'll stop there and let someone else comment.
That's a good observation. I think people today are much more vulnerable to downturns in the economy for a lot of reasons, and the economy is so interconnected. But before I get other comments, I had to smile or chuckle when you mentioned about putting money in mattresses. Some of you may have seen or heard this story on the news this week. I think it was in Israel. You all heard this. Okay, for those of you who didn't, some poor woman had her life savings in her mattress, and I think they said it was something like $1 million in the U.S. equivalent. She got a new mattress.
Her daughter got it.
Okay. Tell the story, Ted. You probably know better than me. Go ahead.
The daughter went out and bought her a new mattress and threw the old mattress out.
And with the money in it.
Yeah, with the money in it. And so she had. They had to go to the government and have them stop dumping so they could go and search the dump for the mattress that they had thrown out.
Did they find it?
I don't know. I never heard that point.
So fiscal conservatism is good. I'm a great believer in that, but check your mattress. Ted, did you want to, Art, you wanted to add something? I'm sorry.
What alerted me more than anything else, I guess, is there was a sheet in the newspaper that says, who owns the U.S.? And then it went right down the list to say that we're in debt at $11 trillion. Well, you know, numbers start to lose their import, you know, and when you put too many zeros after it, you don't understand how much that is. And they said that the foreign owners owe $3.3 trillion out of this. And then it went down the list to tell you Hong Kong had $78 billion that they owe, that we borrowed from them. Germany, 55. United Kingdom, 128 billion. Brazil, 126. And it went down the list to tell you all the countries that own quite a bit of the U.S. country than the country itself. And so I thought, gee whiz, I never paid any attention to that. And it never was that global back in the Depression, where I was kind of a youngster at the time, and I remember Dad going through a few things that caused them a few heartaches. But then it's so global that when it comes to the stock market, you have China, that the stock market went down 48%, the Russian stock market 72%, and the Japanese 42%, U.S. was 35%, England 32%. And so consequently, you can see the global effect this has on all the different countries that makes it another bigger bump in the road than we might anticipate.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, also as the brethren have been talking, this is, you know, we always use the illustration that the economy is like a house of cards. It's all built up and built up, but all it takes is one little, you pull out one peg and the whole thing comes crashing down. And really, you know, one of the real differences between the, you know, our Great Depression back in the 30s and the world as it is today is the fact that, you know, just because it affected us, it didn't affect everybody else that much, as much as it is today, because of the global economy everybody is, as Brother Art was just mentioning, everybody owns a little piece of everybody else. And when everybody owns a little piece of everybody else, all you have to do is start the chain reaction of it going down. And that's one of the reasons why the United States, even though we don't have the background or the resources to do it, the government stepped in and pulled all this money out of the air, so to speak, and infused it into the financial system and into the car market and everybody else, because if they let it go, it would be a worldwide depression. And so they're grasping at straws, and it goes to show you the tendency or the weakness of this whole present social order. It does have its Achilles heel, and we can, you can see how Brother Russell saw it back in his day when he wrote the fourth volume, and we see it even, bigger today.
Yeah, just one quick thing. I know Ted's got something to say. Talking about the fourth volume, there is so much in the fourth volume in the chapter called Preparation of the Elements that reads just like today's newspaper. Brother Russell has a subheading that almost probably was a little bit racist in his day, but it says, "The Yellow Man with the White Man's Money." Brother Russell wrote this 100 years ago. And isn't that exactly what we've seen today? And we've seen it industrially with the rise of Japan's industries 50 years ago, China's industries more recently, and now, as Dan alluded to, China's really owning the United States of America because they own our debt. Ted?
But along that line, along that line, I heard a comment recently that kind of puts it into perspective. It says, realize that if China decides to take their money out of the United States bonds that they hold, they have to have a place to put it. And there is no other place that is safer, it's more reliable, and they're more sure of getting their money back. Secondly, the United States is China's best customer. If the United States government goes bankrupt, China goes bankrupt too, because they got nobody to sell to. So I think we have to don't let these scare tactics take over completely. There may be a gradual a deterioration of the markets and the world economy, but it's not to the point where tomorrow the sky is going to fall.
Yeah, good point. And you mentioned about the United States being a safe haven for investments. I think it was Ted that called my attention to the fact that a few weeks or a month ago, the United States was selling bonds with a negative rate of return. In other words, you give me $100 today, I'll give you $98 a year from now. You might say, well, who would ever give me $100 today and I give them $98? It's because if you put it anywhere else, you're going to get $90 or $80 or $70. So the economy is just so hard to understand. But I want to, if we can, bring this down a personal level. I think what we're saying is, as we see the world economy failing, it's because there is so much debt. And truly, on a personal level, this same concept applies. Stay out of debt, I guess, is the bottom line lesson that all of us would probably say to ourselves and to others. I remember growing up in my household with my mom and dad, who, of course, did go through the Depression as young adults and were very fiscally conservative. They were so attuned to the concept of not getting personally into debt in their household affairs that not only did they never own a credit card all of their lives, they never even had a checking account because they didn't want to even have the possibility of writing a check that could possibly bounce. My parents never owned a credit card or a checking account. I remember going with my dad when he bought a car in 1960. It cost $2,000. He reached into his wallet, he pulled out a $1,000 bill and another $1,000 bill and a couple of hundreds, and he paid for the car with cash. They didn't even have a mortgage because my mom's parents had bought the two houses they owned next door, and they paid off my mom's parents. So anyway, I also learned this fiscal conservative. I never had a bank credit card until I was 40 years old. We had a Sears card in our 20s and 30s, but never a bank card. My point is, today, and tell me if you agree with this or you see it differently, It used to be debt was something to be avoided. Bankruptcy was a lifelong shame. Today, debt is good. People are supposed to spend more than they have so that they can get the good things in life. And if you go into debt, it's no problem. And if you have to declare bankruptcy, that's just another bank transaction that everybody does. And so I think I've seen this great shift, not only in the governments in a macroeconomic sense, but among individuals in a microeconomic sense. What are your thoughts about, you know, how should we be looking? What should we be advising our brethren and our children and our grandchildren about going into debt? Anybody? Aaron?
Well, I have two daughters in college. They both have credit cards. And we pay their bills for them, help them out. But we tell them that you don't spend money you don't have. And we also remind them that, you know, they're looking, they're at the age of perhaps getting married in the near future. So we tell them, we remind them that you want to make all of your investment decisions on one income. So that should something happen, you're not maxed out, that you both have to work or that you can't afford to pay something because you expect the other income. So it means basically that you cut back a little bit. You don't buy the house your parents have because it took them 30 years to get to it. You start out with something smaller. You don't buy everything brand new. You start out with something less. You just settle for less. The aspect of credit depends upon who you talk to. If you talk to the Christian and you listen to the Christian community, they're dead set against credit or very, very judicious use of the credit. I don't think there's anything wrong with using a credit card. You know, it's very hard to always have cash on hand. Sometimes it's not safe to have cash. So the use of a credit card is a very good thing at times. Can it lead to overspending? Absolutely. In my own, plus the fact that if you don't use the credit wisely, you're going to get into a deeper and deeper debt. And just as an example, we have an excellent credit rating, both my wife and I, but also our business has an excellent credit rating. I just got two letters from our credit card companies. One said we're totally shutting down your line of credit completely because the funding source for the whole account, the whole credit line of cards, was eliminated. So everybody who had this kind of card was just shut down. The other letter said, you know, we appreciate you being a good customer, but across the board we're doubling your interest rate. And he said it's nothing personal, it's just across the board we're doubling your interest rate. So we went from 9.9 to 18.9. And I called them up and they said, you know, it's nothing personal. It's just that we're not making the money that we need to make. Now, I work for the banks and I work for credit card companies, and the credit card companies are the cash cows of the banking industry. That's where their finances are or their profits are made. And they push the credit card very heavily. So in the Christian world, they're saying cut back on your spending and your credit cards. In the banking industry, of course, if you buy more than what you can legitimately pay for, they're making money on you, right? And in the banking industry, unfortunately, one of the senior vice presidents told me that this industry will hire the greediest people they can find. That's a direct quote to run the companies because they know they'll make money doing that. So you've got two different polar opposites, you know. One, the Christian principle says don't spend more than you can pay for. The other principle, and everything that you see in the news and the media and your business schools all teach credit's a good thing, right? Credit's a good thing. You should spend money because you should borrow and have loans out there because it allows you to build your business. What they don't tell you is that when that credit's withdrawn, how are you going to survive your cash flow problems because you don't have that expected line of credit? They don't really cover that, and they don't want to.
Yeah. Once they own your debt, they own you. Ted, you had something you wanted to add?
Well, I just think that the credit card companies are greedy beyond all words. They even are starting to crack down on those who pay off their bill every month. They're trying to find a way to charge them extra. This morning on the radio, on the television, there was a news program that had a financial section, and two things were mentioned by the two men that they were interviewing. And the first one was that the recovery from this financial downturn will be very gradual and will not be total. his thought was that it wouldn't, that gradually the economy will come back up, but it won't come up to what it was a year ago. The other man used these words. He said, "Armageddon is past." I thought that was an interesting way, because some of our brethren that we know of are using that term.
Art? The only thing we can offer, I think, is to live within your means. If you got too many credit cards, cut them up. Just go with one. You got cell phones in your family, you don't need one for all five children. You can get by with just two, you and your wife. You know, so you got to look at these things. Why send your youngster, or not a youngster, your teenager to Harvard or Princeton when it would just be just as much more reasonable? Send them to local school. And I like the culture of the Jewish people. Send your child to school. Give him a degree, but make sure you have him learn how to work with his hands, because now is the time where he might not have a job with his education, but at least he could put bread on the table by helping the carpenter or somebody else. Yeah. And so that, I think that those were... But as far as we're concerned, I think as brethren, we should man our post, as the pastor puts it, stay awake, do not slumber. If it comes to unity amongst the brethren, which was brought up earlier, careful who you unify with. As the time goes on, there's less and less on this side, more and more on the other side. So unity is a great thing, but at the end of the age, you might have to know that the sifting process is taking place, and we have to prove ourselves. We should sound the trumpet, and we shouldn't forget to look out the window to see what's going on.
Good point. Dan, anything to add?
I think the most important thing is to, you know, it's almost impossible these days, like, to buy a house. When my parents bought a house, you know, they had a very small mortgage, but the prices of today, you can't buy a house without going into debt. And what you can do though is to minimize the debt as much as possible. And that's the thing and that's why, you know, so much of the foreclosures today, which is again, on the definite increase, this hasn't slowed down. They keep talking about in the news how they're going to do this and they're going to do that. If you look at the statistics, it's going up. It's not coming down, and more people are losing their homes. And this is what's going to bring dissatisfaction. This is what we see. Brother Russell in his day on page 312 of the fourth volume in the Preparations of the Elements, section, he says, why recent favorable conditions cannot continue. And he goes into, I like this one paragraph. Let's just read the one paragraph, because he says, it may be suggested that the rich and the poor have lived together for 6,000 years and that there is no room for danger or of calamity resulting, now than in the past. No more the danger of the rich will crush the poor and let them starve. And we can see that they cannot do this anymore. They could do this, years ago, talking about before our Lord's presence in 1874. This was, you didn't have it. They just, nobody cared. They can't get away with that anymore. What's interesting to me is the fact that on all these price increases in that, like in gasoline, they push it up. They can only keep it up there for so long. They have to bring it down because they're having riots at the pumps. They're having, people shooting one another. And you can't have a society can't live like that. And they recognize this fact. And so that they pull back. The biggest problem is that they never pull it back towards where it theoretically should be, because if you on one hand you find they're claiming that they have no outlets, everybody's cutting back, and so therefore they have to keep the price up. they fail to recognize, or they fail to tell you the facts of that they're making more money than they've ever made on one hand they're crying, oh, I'm hurting, and on the other hand they're making money like a hand over fist. And one of the things that is very telling is the fact of Tribune here, and I can't remember whether it was I think it was last Sunday's paper. And if you look at this headlines, it goes investigations with impasse, and then it talks about poison in the well, infant car seats are being questioned, neighborhoods that are for sale, elevator safety, emergency rooms that are not providing what they say that they're going to provide. And clout, you know, it's who you know, you can get into, you know, colleges. All of these things, you never heard about them before. Mm-hmm. Now, they're front headline news. And I think that's, again, what's happening is the fact that nothing, just as the scripture says, nothing in that day shall be hid, but it shall be made known. And even though they're, And this is why, you know, it was always been business as usual in politics. Our last two governors are now, you know, one's under indictment, the other one's in prison.
Along with three or four more from earlier decades.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, you know, people just aren't willing to take it anymore. Yeah. And that's what's, again, providing the things that keep us to know where we are in the stream of time, and things are, you know, heading to a climax.
I want us to talk about one more aspect of this, and then if you have any final discussion points, we can bring them up. But let's bring it down to the personal level here. We talked about how governments are in debt. Individuals should stay out of debt. But we have some brethren who are in debt. They've lost their jobs. They're hurting. How do we help them? How do we give them advice? You know, we're all men up here, and men traditionally have the role of being the provider in the family, the protector of the family. And when that's taken away from us, it hurts us, I think, much more than even our wives can sometimes understand, that we've been stripped almost of what makes us a man, being the provider and the protector of the family, bringing home the paycheck. And I think that really bothers some of our fellow brethren when they find themselves in that situation. They might have a tendency to say, you know, I'm worthless. They may not even want to come to the meetings anymore, which is probably the worst thing they could do because they feel so ashamed. So what are your thoughts on when we know our brethren have lost their jobs and they're hurting financially, and how can we help them? What can we do? Aaron?
Bernard? Well, I've been through two or three downsizings. I forget how many even. I have to think through it. But, and it is. It's emotionally challenging as a man. You know, you're doing your very best. You're getting good performance reviews. Everybody's happy with the work you're doing. All of a sudden, they come in and they say, your job's gone. It's nothing personal. It isn't. It's a business decision. We can't afford to keep or maintain this particular division or effort or whatever. It's a difficult one. I've been in the end that I have to tell people your job's gone. And you know, and as in management, I knew it was going to happen a month before it was going to happen. But we couldn't say anything because the company's worried about sabotage. If people find out in advance, then they sabotage stuff. So, you know, I've seen both sides. I've been walked out the door, and I've had to walk people out the door. And it's never a pleasant thing. And it is. It's a very difficult thing as a man emotionally. And your natural reaction is to, or at least mine was a couple times as well, all right. You know, you're just kind of stunned. What do you do now? Where do you go? Where do you start? What do you do? So I think that's kind of at least for me, it was a natural thing. So if you're experiencing that layoff or unexpected downturn, I think the first thing I do is recognize that, yeah, it really does have an emotional impact on you. And if you can acknowledge it, that's your first step to stepping past and through it. Admit it. Okay, I'm having a problem with this. If you can't talk to it with your family or your spouse, then find somebody you can talk to and share it. And especially if you can find someone that's gone through it themselves, it helps, a little bit of experience before you. But then it comes down to, okay, now you have to get up and get on. But that's personal. So now, if I know that somebody has lost their job, then I believe I have a responsibility to help them in some way. And unfortunately, I've not always been able to do that. And it doesn't mean I wouldn't like to, but I've not always been able to. But the thing that I can do, and we try to do, is remember them in prayer. And I think as Brother Jim Parkin said, the best way to talk about somebody is when you're on your knees. And that's really very true. So that doesn't help that individual immediately. But I believe there's a power of prayer that supersedes and controls far greater than just handing them, you know, a check. But I will admit, we've been on the receiving ends of checks, and it's humiliating a little bit. And there's a lot of gratitude, a lot of thankfulness when it comes in. So if you're in the position to help, then you can do it. It means a lot to the people receiving it.
All right.
I go back to the depression a little bit, and I remember, and I think that's one thing we have to do is if the breadwinner is laid off or off two days a week or something of work, why the other member of the family has to perhaps fill in the details, fill in the other end of it if he can. I remember when I was a little fella, why Dad worked for International Harvester, and he was down to 2 days a week, and so things got a little tight. And so he brought it up, and Mom, of course, she thought she's got to do something. So I was preschool yet, and I remember being dragged down to the bus, got on the Versi bus, went to Milwaukee Avenue, and she went downtown, and she was sewing collars for one outfit. She saw it in the newspaper that they needed a seamstress or somebody who knew how to sew. So she went down there, and she was sewing collars. And then she'd be bringing them home, sew them at home, and then once every week we'd go downtown, and I'd be dragged along as you know, because she couldn't leave me with anybody. And so we had that trip. So the point there I got was that, you know, sometimes we have to overlap, and the mother has to do some, you know, get to work and so on in order to supplement the income. And so then she went on to do a lot of sewing dresses, draperies, and so on and so forth. And so a little finances were coming in that way.
Any last comments on this or any aspect of the economy? Dan and then Ted.
I think, you know, one of the things is that, you know, this is where, you know, we as a family, you know, we have family that's blood family, and then we have family that's ecclesia family. And wherever if we see the need and we have the means, then we help one another, just as one member of the family helps another member of the family. You know, and I think that the overall viewpoint, though, is you have to remember, if you are truly consecrated to the Lord is not going to give you any experience that you cannot bear. He doesn't say it's going to be easy, but you know, it is, if it's happening, you know, I've used this from, you know, for myself over the years, that if it's happening to me, then the Lord is permitting it for a reason. And I can do it with His help, of course, and with the brethren's help, of course. And with, you know, and this is why, you know, we have to look out at one another. One of the things we have at our elders' meetings, every meeting, is we have the welfare of the ecclesia is one of the things that we definitely talk about. And if we see the need, then we act upon it. And I think that's the right spirit, and that's what is pleasing to our Heavenly Father.
Good. Ted?
This problem of layoffs amongst the brethren has come up probably more right at this present time. But in the last couple decades, it's been a trend. As you get older, the companies have less use for you. And when you get over 50, they're looking to find someone to replace you because you're earning more than they can hire somebody for. And so you have to remember that these are problems that are not only faced at the present, but have been right along. I mean, brethren have experienced that for the last several decades. It used to be where if you started as a youngster with a company, you could work your whole life there. I had an uncle that worked for the Daily News. He started when he was 15. He retired when he was 65. He was there 50 years. But that was a common thing back in those days, and it's not anymore.
Yeah, good point. Things have changed. Any last comments from anybody on any aspect of the failing economy? And then we're going to move on. Aaron?
Well, just a real quick comment that, you know, you might be financially set today because you have a pension. But if the company that's supplying you that pension goes into bankruptcy, your pension's gone. Or it can be gone. And that's going to happen more and more. And what they don't talk about in the media is the downstream effects of all these bankruptcies. You know, GM's going to be bailed out, or Chrysler's going to be bailed out, right? So all this money that's going into them is coming from the taxpayers. But what happened to all the suppliers who supplied products to GM or Chrysler, who now had their debt eliminated, right? So Chrysler's debt's no longer there, but all these other companies are out all this money. So now they can't meet their cash flow, and they can't meet their payroll, so now they lay off their people. And these people can't pay or make the bills. Now, you know, so it starts to exponentially explode, if you will. And there's no discussion in the media. It's everybody says, okay, we just got to bail out this company because it's an American icon, right? But there's no talk about the downstream effects. Same thing with, our society is based on greed, unfortunately. We're all greedy people. If we look in the mirror and we're honest, we'll admit it. We're all very greedy. So when an executive takes a bonus at the end of the year because they laid off so many people and they made their expense ratios, right, $1 million bonus to them doesn't change their style of living one bit. It's a numbers game. They're comparing themselves to someone else. They're doing the similar job, same number of people, same basic revenue for the company. They should be paid this much. If CEO A is getting a bonus, and me as a CEO, I want the same bonus or more. $1 million will keep 20 families solvent for a year. That's $50,000. 20 people, 20 families. And it won't change the CEO's standard of living one bit. So that's, you know, so we have this internal greed, but I think I would just close with saying that trust the Lord. You know, I know it's real easy to say that. It's much harder to live it. But when you put your trust in the Lord, then a little is exponentially expanded into a lot. And I don't know how that works. It's like the widow's mite, but it happens. And I can testify to that. The little that we had for a while has been expanded. And we look back, it's like, how in the world did we ever manage? But we did. And we know and recognize it as because of the Lord. So trust Him. Really, really trust Him.
Okay, very good. Again, I guess the bottom line is be fiscally conservative. If you're in debt, do the best you can to get out of debt. Stay out of debt if you're not in debt, but don't put your money in the mattress. Let's move on to our second area of
Ted. Okay, Ted has one more.
Just thought of something. I had a chance to talk with a brother at our convention recently. And we were talking about finances, and that is a brother who has experience in that field. And he said that, we're all kind of greedy. He said, especially those of us that have 401k accounts, he says, we're used to seeing them increase 10% every year. And he said, that's what the world is looking for, always more, more, more than what they have. And he said, we ought to get away from that. And somebody asked him point blank, well, what do you think we ought to invest in? And of course, he didn't want to give us the name of a company or that. But he did say this, and I thought it was reasonable. He said, we ought to be satisfied with 1-3% profit after inflation. In other words, if inflation is even for the year, and we made 2% on our money, we should be very happy with that. And I thought, that's something to think about. Are we satisfied with something like that? He said, beyond that, it's greed. And so I thought it was a good admonition for us.
That's good. Art wants to add something, and then I want to add something, too. I think we're going to spend our whole time on this topic. Go ahead, Art.
I don't recommend this, but I just picked this up in the newspaper recently, and it says the ones that are really thriving in this particular industry is counterfeiting. when this last year or two, they had $64 million that they pumped into the people, and the people have been going after it. You know, they're just making counterfeit money, and all of a sudden it's going all over, and it's thriving like a mushroom.
The comment I was going to make is that Ted was talking about being satisfied with a small but steady return on your investments, which again is a conservative investment scheme. And I heard an economic analyst describe how it is that we are in the situation we are in as individuals and as nations. And he said that the thinking of investors and people in the money markets and everyday people like us has changed over the years from an investment mentality to a trader mentality. And what he meant by that was people used to invest in stocks and in bonds, and their thinking was, how much will this asset earn me over the long term? People don't think that way anymore. They've adopted a trader mentality, which is a much shorter term. And their sentiment is, how much can I sell this asset, this stock or this bond for tomorrow? And that's greed. And like Ted said, all of us maybe start to think a little more short term. What can I get quickly for this, rather than am I going to be happy with just a low return but a steady return over a long period of time? And so it is interesting that this mentality, this attitude permeates the world. And if we're not careful, it can permeate ourselves too, where we start to think in those short-term gains over long-term investment strategies. Let's move on to our area number two, religion. We see a lot in the news today about religion. There's current events left and right regarding what the Pope is saying, the fact that the makeup of the Catholic Church is changing. It's becoming more and more Hispanic, less and less Western European. The rise of Islam. There are more and more Muslims, and there are some predictions that at the rate of childbirth among Muslim populations that there will be more Muslims than Christians in the entire globe in a matter of perhaps just a few decades. So as you read all these things, what strikes your mind there? And I see you've got a chart there in front of you. Why don't you tell us, if you'd like, what that chart Sure. tells us and what, if anything, it means for us that we need to be concerned about.
I have another comment before I get into this.
Go ahead.
I was listening to the news a little, probably about 2 weeks ago, and they're talking about the birth rate and the death rate of countries. And what they're finding out is that the westernized countries have a declining birth rate, which means that in 20 years, already the rate of births is less than the rate of death. So what that means is that in 20, 25 years or so, or less, the dynamics are going to change so much. Right now, like the French people, when a country accepts the Muslim population in, their birth rate is atrociously high. Now, it's not a negative thing. It's a very high birth rate. So what they're seeing is that the balance is going to significantly change within 20, 25 years, where the current population, whether it's, you know, Russian, Polish, French, is declining to the point where the Muslims are taking the birth rate so much higher. Well, in 25 years, they're even talking about a parity or even a majority. And now you're going to have people who are going to be active in voting because they're younger versus a declining age or an aging population who are less active in the politics. So they're really concerned about major swings in the whole ideological and religious structure of a country just because of that declining birth rate. And no nation can pull out and survive, statistically or historically, a declining birth rate. No nation's ever recovered from that. So that was really interesting. Now, the chart I have, I found on a website, and Brother Dan has exactly the same one, but it just breaks down religions of the world ranked by numbers, and Christianity across the globe is about 33%. Islam is 21% right now. And again, because the birth rate's so high in Islamic nations, they're seeing that it's going to have a major shift in a short time. Hinduism is 14%, Chinese traditional 6%, Buddhism is 6%, Judaism is 1/4% of a percent of the global economy. Let's see what else. And then they have the African, the primal indigenous, and that's about 6%. And then 16% of the world population is non-religious. So the Christianity is 33% and Islam is 21%. But again, they're expecting a major shift to occur. And as that occurs, the whole dynamics of how the country interacts with other countries will change, and how the voting and who they put into power, of course, that affects their relationships with other countries. So we're going to see some major upheavals, I think, in the very near time.
Yeah, this is something that bears watching. So that familiar chart in Volume 1 that shows people by the major religions of the world, of course, heathenism outnumbered them all, is changing dramatically. It's been pretty much stable for 100 years, but in the last 10, 20, 30 years, and looking forward to the next 20 or so, there are some changes. Dan, you wanted to add something about that?
I was just looking at, they had 22 categories and Christianity was 2.1 billion, and then you had Islam is 1.5 billion, and then it keeps going down and says, I'll just go down the list here, and it says 1.1 billion, 900 billion. These are all different religions other than Christianity. 900 million, 394 million, 376 million, 300 million, 100 million, 23 million, 19 million, 15 million. And it just goes down. You can see where Brother Russell's chart back in the first volume in his day was there. It's now, the non-Christian world has increased quite, significantly. If the Christian religion is converting the world, we're losing. They were losing back in Brother Russell's day. They're losing worse today. And it goes to prove the point of that this is not the time for the conversion of the world. And statistics prove that. And what it tells us is that the divine plan of the ages is right on target.
Good point.
I noticed one other observation that maybe we could make, and we'll have just a few minutes to discuss this before we close, is that there seems to be a trend, even in the Christian world, of losing faith in the established churches, the Protestant churches, the Catholic churches, to the extent that people begin to feel that, I don't need a church. I don't have to go to a particular denomination to be right with God, to have a relationship with God. I can have my own spirituality within me. I call this the Oprah Winfrey effect, because if you watch Oprah, she'll tell you that when she was a young girl raised in the church that she was, when the preacher would talk about, bad people go to hell and all that, it just didn't mesh with her concept of a God of love. And so now she espouses more of a personal spirituality. You have to find your own inner core of beliefs and goodness and holiness and principles as much in harmony with God as you can. And so I think we see this in the world, and the just comment I'll make, and then we'll open up for your last few comments, is, we have to perhaps watch that maybe some of that tendency or thinking might not become our thinking, where we begin to think that, my individual relationship with God is superior to anything that I need or can get from the ecclesia arrangement, so that we start to not value as highly as we should being with the brethren, being a part of an ecclesia, supporting the ecclesia, instead desiring perhaps to be off on our own. Dan?
There was just one other statistics I wanted to bring forth, and then, that was world religion, okay? There was also a breakdown of religion in the United States. And now in here, you can see that there's quite a bit of difference. This is from 2007, okay? It was 78.4% were Christian. Of that 78.4%, there were 51% Protestant, 24% Catholics, and everybody else was down. Latter-day Saints was 1.7%. Everybody else was under 1%. In number two, there was no religion at all, and that was 16%. Judaism 1.7%, Buddhism 0.7%, Islam 0.6%, Hinduism 0.4%, and all others were less than a total of 1.2%. So this country, even though what we hear and see when people say what religion they are, and this isn't to say how many, you know, go to church on Sunday, it's just the question was, what religion, you know, are you in? Are you Christian or, you know, or some of these others? But I thought it was, you know, really interesting that this country is still Protestant, mostly. Over 50% of the population in 2007, which is not too long ago, was 50% of the population considered themselves Protestant. And I think that, you know, it lends itself to, this is why you saw so much, you know, religion, spark of religion, or surge of religion is a better terminology, from 2001 on, is because, you know, this country still has a very strong religious background. And the churches are obviously going to foster that.
And try to
as much as possible.
Good. Art?
Well, one thing I noticed was that there's a large influx to the mega churches, and primarily you take care of my present needs, which can be divorce, drugs, it could be whatever, and we have meetings during the week, come at 7 o'clock on Tuesday, and you can handle the children problem or some other problems. And so the people are kind of going in that direction. But one thing we notice also is that the Church of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, are growing by 1.6 to 2%, and primarily quite a bit in South America, Brazil, and Mexico. And it seems like the people there go in for the crystal chandeliers and the lifestyle that these people have, because the Lord blesses them in basket and in store, because they're obedient. They follow the principal concepts of the Scriptures.
Good point. Ted?
Well, this is not about religion, but there was one additional, I mean, two additional things that we didn't touch on, and that I think are problems for society today. One of them is health care, and that's being discussed now in Congress. But it seems that there's a general attitude that everyone should have health care, but there are so many questions about who's going to pay for it, and can the nation afford it? Can we cover everyone? And what will be covered? And all those kind of questions in it, that it shows that that's not an easy problem for them to follow. But one thing I found in the current issue of National Geographic, there's a 34-page analysis on the food production and the growth of population in the world. It said that, let me just read you a couple things that it said. It said 35% of the world's grain is used to feed cattle. Corn used to make 25 gallons of ethanol would feed one person for a whole year. But we've seen that that's not where the farmers are putting their corn, because it's more profitable to go to ethanol. For almost the last decade, the world has been consuming more food than it produces. Now, that's an unusual and, I think, very significant statement. In 2007, the world saw the global carryover stocks fall to 61%, or 61 days. In other words, the food production from last year would last 61 days if we had nothing else to add to it. In 61 days, the world would be out of food. It's a staggering thing to think of. It takes five times more grain to get the equivalent amount of calories from eating pork as from eating the grain itself. 10 times more if we're talking about grain-fattened cattle. So in other words, we're wasting more by having a meat-based society. You know, it takes much more to feed. China cannot feed its own pigs. It's become a big pork-consuming nation, and they can't grow enough corn to feed them. They're importing the feed from the United States. And last of all, last year, 9 million acres of forest were damaged or destroyed to turn them into fields that are growing corn or grain of some kind in order to feed the people. So they said, you know, in a few years, we will have an 8 billion figure for population of the world. And they're questioning whether or not they have the resources to be able to feed that many. If they have, it means they will have to double the production that we have today. Double the production in less than 20 years.
Hmm. Interesting statistics. Aaron? I'll give everybody a last chance to make a last comment. We'll start with Aaron and go down the table.
Right. I know it's late, but there's not one problem that the world is facing that the Lord Jesus cannot resolve. And that's probably why he's going to rule with a rod of iron, because he has to change men's hearts. And he's going to force the issue so that men make and women make the right decision instead of the natural decision. So as bad as it sounds, and it does sound terrible, there's not one thing that the Lord cannot resolve. So if we put our trust in him, he's promised us that he's going to watch over us. He's promised us his kingdom. He's promised us a time. He's promised the whole world of mankind. There'll be a time where there'll be no more pain, no more sin, no more sorrow, no more worry, because all these things have passed away. And for you and I, if we're faithful, we'll have the opportunity to participate in that. And when you're facing the experiences that you're going through now, whatever they are, big or small, just remember that the Lord cares enough for you to tailor that experience for you. For he has a long-term objective for each of us. It's not just today's experiences, it's a long-term one. So be patient in him, trust him, and be aware of opportunities to help and share and lighten the load for someone else when you have that opportunity.
Good point. Seek meekness, seek righteousness, it may be you'll be hid. Ted, any closing comments?
Just that I don't think that's a bad sign. I think it's just a sign that the kingdom is close. When we look at all the problems that the world is facing, we have to realize that society as it is today cannot go on very long.
Yeah. And even though we're in the midst of it, we're above it, protected from it. Art, any closing thoughts?
Well, just amen to what Brother Aaron mentioned, but what I ran across was, in a little added feature, was that the bear is not dead, and the bear is the Russians. And just recently in the paper, it mentions the fact how Putin was hugging the Orthodox high priest there of the church, and the millions that they have following him, and how the Russians becoming more active in the Arctic, in the Baltic countries, in Georgia, in Cuba, and various other places. And they mentioned the fact that a country that has suffered communism breakdown is starting to move ahead. And the question is, they got their eye on the Jew and on Jerusalem and on the oil in that area and so on and so forth. So we have to remember that he's not sleeping.
Good point. Dan, closing word?
Just as, and, you know, amen to what all the brethren have said. I think that one of the things is and when Obama being elected president, you know, is the Lord is giving mankind every opportunity to, so that in the kingdom, nobody can ever say, well, if we only gave us an opportunity, we could have brought it. We could have done it. There isn't anything that imperfect man can do to change the system. You know, and that's what, you know, it's interesting that already Obama is reneging on a number of the, quote, election promises that he made. He's now saying, you know, we just can't do that. And I found that very interesting. He's only been in office now for, you know, from January to June, and he's already starting to negate, say he can't do some of the things that he promised he could do.
Yeah, current events certainly bears watching, not only on a global level, but individually how it affects us and our relationship with the Lord. Well, I'd like to thank the panel members for rising to the challenge I gave them of carrying on a discussion without a lot of structure to the outline or to the references, and I may just decide to like panels once again.